You're listening to Next Stop CPA, the official podcast for the CPA exam, brought to you by the AICPA.
Welcome to another episode of Next Stop CPA. Most CPA exam candidates can rest assured knowing the time and energy they've spent leading up to exam day has prepared them for what to expect. Reviewed content and structure, section by section in the blueprints, check. Practice with the sample test to learn the exam's functionality, check. Confirmed test windows, how scoring works, and made the test day appointment, check. Understood the importance of language in the exam and what goes into the wording of each question, Understanding what goes into the development of exam questions may provide extra insight for test day when you sit for the exam, which surely adds to your confidence. Today we'll be exploring the importance of language on the exam. I'm joined by Renee Varias, Senior Manager of Test Development, and Dr. Timothy Habick, Test Development Manager, both with the AICPA exams team. Today, they'll be sharing some of the behind-the-scenes considerations of language on the exam, from creation to approval, fairness in the wording, as well as knowing with certainty that each multiple-choice question only has one right answer. Renee, Tim, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting us.
So let's get right to it. Can you tell us a little bit about why your role with the exam is so important?
There's really nothing more important than the clarity of the wording of the exam questions. We're really trying to get at what the candidate knows, and we don't want them to try to decipher confusing wording to even understand the question. The question should be clear so that they can get right to answering the question.
That's right, Renee. It's so important that when the test taker looks at our questions, that there is no roadblocks in processing the question and processing the wording. So you might wonder, why would the CPA exam employ a person like me who has a background in linguistics and logic for an exam on accounting topics? And the reason is that it might take a linguist or a logician to take the logic and the linguistics out of the question. What we want to do is to make sure that when you're reading the question, you have no problems in processing it. And so what I'm trying to do in my review of each question is to remove any problems that might occur. When you're looking at the questions, you probably will not notice them because we've already been poring over them to remove any problematical issues.
Now, do you review every single question before it's approved to go on an actual live exam?
Many times, yes. Anytime someone touches the question, changes the wording a little bit, it goes back to test development review because that may have introduced some confusion, some not ideal wording that could confuse the candidate.
Can you give an example of some not ideal wording that might confuse a candidate?
One of my favorites is actually one that everyone has seen, but you may not know what it's called, and it's called garden pathing. When you read a sentence and you think it means a certain thing until you hit a word, you've been led down the garden path of this sentence, and there are so many words in the English language that have more than one meaning. And you're reading the sentence and all of a sudden you have to go back to the beginning and try a different meaning of a word to get to the proper sentence, what's intended.
So that's like a fork in the road of when you're processing this, a particular sentence. You get to you hit upon a word that can be analyzed as either a noun or a verb. And so your task at that point is to say, okay, I guess it's a noun, and move on to the next word. Well, if the next word doesn't support your analysis of that first question as a noun, you might need to go back and analyze that word as a verb. There's the famous example of the complex houses, both graduate and undergraduate students. And that's an example of a garden pathing sentence that we can all understand immediately.
When you first read the sentence, you might think houses is a plural noun. But as you continue reading the sentence, it doesn't make any sense that way. You have to go back to the beginning and read it as a verb, and then the sentence makes sense. And we don't want candidates to have to reanalyze a sentence to make it make sense. We want to change the wording so that there's only one way to read the sentence. It's actually kind of fun to go onto the internet and Google garden pathing in language, because you can get some really fun examples.
It's funny because the English language is known to be a little bit more complicated than other languages out there.
Yeah.
I learned that firsthand with my son. I was telling my husband a few weeks ago that my voice was feeling a little hoarse, and he's four. He looks at me with this look of shock and says, "You have a little horse in your throat?" And so I realize, I'm like, oh, you know, like when they're that young, they don't know that there's multiple meanings to words. So I think it translates as, you know, as we're considering the exam and the language on the exam, we want people to know exactly what we mean the first time around that they read through it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, what it sounds like is that, you know, the question needs to be completely clear. We want candidates to understand it the first read through. How about the answers to the questions? Could there be more than one right answer to a question?
Of course, there could be more than one correct answer to a question. And this is both a technical issue as well as a linguistic and logical issue.
We do statistical monitoring of the pretest questions, you know, the tests that are put on the exam, that we gather statistics that hopefully if something was missed, if there's some possibility that there's a second correct answer, we hope that the statistics will point that out to us. But we go through so many layers of review of the items to try to avoid that happening, that when it does happen, it's really quite an exception.
And pretest questions, just to elaborate, those are questions that make it to an exam, but they don't count towards a candidate's score, right? It's more us trying to figure out if this question is worthy of actually making it to the final exam, right?
Yes, because some questions, although there's one right answer, they're written clearly, they might be too easy. They might be, the difficulty of the question isn't always in the subject matter. It's also in how are the options phrased? Is the correct answer just the only plausible one? So one of the things that we read through, and you know, Tim and I are not CPAs, our strength is in the language, but if I read a CPA exam question and I know the answer, then I'll raise my hand and say, hey, I know this one. So I don't think this is going to discriminate between the high performing candidates and the low performing candidates very well. So I think that's a common theme in test development is, why don't you have subject matter experts doing the test development as well? And a lot of times they are distracted by the subject matter. They might read a question and there's some bit of missing information. They may say, well, the candidate will know that's what we mean. And, you know, we as test developers look at these questions and say, no, there's a logical gap there. You can't just assume that they will know that little missing bit of information. So that's one of the benefits that we add to it. And like I said, also the plausibility of the distractors. If we know the answer, then it's probably not worth a spot on the exam.
So what we do is attend to how a picture is being built up in the language setup for the question. Is each piece of information introduced at the right time? Should there be a repetition of a piece of information, or would that repetition be distracting because it has already been established? So this is the a look at the communicative structure of a particular piece of text to make sure that each idea is presented at the right time and in the right place for the candidate to fully process the question.
It sounds like there's just so much of a specific process that goes into this. Now, would you say in the testing world, you know, beyond just the CPA exam, you know, the bar exam or any other kind of high stakes exam, do they have this kind of process as well, do you think?
Well, all of the big exams have to do this because we rely on the credibility of our process. And these are high stakes examinations. And if we get something wrong, it can affect hundreds or maybe thousands of test takers. And it's our duty to prevent such problems.
We went through an exercise a few years ago because the way we were processing our exam questions, it took about 2 years between the time when a question was written and that it actually ended up on the exam. And we thought that was excessive. And CPAs are known to be cautious and thorough, but even the CPAs on staff said, that's a little ridiculous. I think we need to shorten that process so that we can get new material on the exam much more quickly. So we went through an exercise where we visited other high-stakes testing organizations to find out what their process was. And we came up with a much shorter process now where we can actually get, if we needed to, we could get an item on the exam in about a month or two and have sufficient review, and we're confident with the process. But there are certain steps that we cannot skip. So we always have, you know, a certain number of external CPA reviewers, and we have our internal staff review the questions so that we are confident that the questions are of very high quality before they hit the exam.
And what Renee is speaking to, the thorough process that each question goes through, that's actually going to be covered in another episode focused on the general overview of how an exam question comes to be from start to finish. But the language component is just so important. Would you say that majority of questions that get drafted eventually make it to the final exam, or do you find a lot of issues with the language that sometimes just can't be worked out, or maybe they can be worked out? For example, if there's a problem that has a specific date noted to it or a company name, is that something that you have to consider as a potential distractor for candidates?
Well, only a small percentage of the questions that we create actually make it onto the operational portion. That is the portion that counts towards the candidate score of the test. So it is, what is the percentage, Renee?
I think it's maybe 40%.
And so we put a lot of work into the questions as we're developing them. A lot of them fall by the wayside during the development process. Now, it is rarely the case, but sometimes, that this type of question cannot be asked in English in a clear way. That sometimes happens. However, more, and for that reason, the question has to be rejected, because perhaps the topic is too complex for a relatively small multiple choice question. But more likely, the reason for a question to fail along the way is because of content issues. And when we have a team of content experts looking at the question, they will find other ways of examining the question that could produce a second correct answer. If those cannot be eliminated, those problems cannot be eliminated readily, we might reject the question at that time too.
Yeah, we may have a requirement to have, or in the blueprint, that we want to ask questions on a certain topic. And it may be considered a very, very important topic. But you may only be able to write one or two questions on it because it's a narrow topic. And so even though it's important and we think we want a lot of questions on it, as these questions get written and they come in-house and our internal staff looks at it and say, we have a half dozen questions that are almost exactly like this one. We just can't accept any more. So sometimes questions die because of that. Or it could be that when you write the question, you just can't come up with plausible distractors, you know, the wrong answers. The candidates pretty much know what the right answer is, and all the wrong ones look wrong. So it's a difficult topic to test in a multiple choice. It may be a good candidate for a simulation, but maybe not a multiple choice.
Now, Renee, you bring up the topic of distractors. Those are the incorrect options to the question. Now, they must be absolutely wrong, yet plausible. That's the challenge about them, that they look at first glance perhaps to be right, but there is something fundamentally wrong with them. So for our answer choices, there is one correct answer we determine, and three incorrect answers for multiple choice ones that are plausible yet incorrect and definitely incorrect. So there are not gradients of incorrectness in most cases, unless we ask for which is the most important, then there might be a gradient. But even when we ask for which is the most important, we will make sure that all of the incorrect answer choices are relatively unimportant.
One of the exercises that we do that test developers especially feel is very important is when a question is written, the writer provides a rationale for what are we getting at in this question? Why are we asking this question? And also gives rationales for the four options, why the correct option is correct and why the incorrect options are incorrect. So they have to justify why, you know, I'm saying that this is wrong and this is why I'm saying it's wrong.
And when there are numerical options, the point is that those numbers in the incorrect answer choices are not drawn out of a hat, but will reflect the misapplication of a rule or some other misapplication of a regulation, and will not be a mere mathematical failure to add properly or something like that.
So basically, they're plausible answers if you've done the equation the wrong way. So people might get that response and say, oh, I got the right answer, but in reality, they just did the equation incorrectly.
That's yeah. Right.
Okay. Yes.
I've heard that it's important to leave emotion, you know, out of it when you're looking at a question, you know, because we want to ensure that candidates are able to focus solely on the content and not be distracted by anything other than the content. Can you sort of explain how that's considered?
Yes. Well, this is a sensitivity issue and a fairness issue that is applied to all high stakes examinations at Educational Testing Service at AICPA and other big testing companies. We need to take the emotion out of test questions. For the CPA exam, we go to extremes to take it out because we realize there is no need for material that will provide any emotional reaction by the candidates to reading the material. Now, certain types of emotional issues are required for the CPA exam, such as death, when we're trying to determine the, say, reporting category that you will use for your 1040, you would be under what circumstances, if your spouse dies, will you be able to claim married filing jointly or something like that. So in that case, we do have to talk about death, and we might in some cases need to talk about diseases, but we don't talk about how the person died in a car crash or what kind of medicine the person needs to take, if that is perhaps a tax deduction.
Is that because it could trigger people, maybe if that's something that sort of hits close to them?
That's right. There will be candidates who are taking the exam who have a family member perhaps who died of some disease. So we just don't mention those things. However, when question writers start out writing their questions, they put these aspects of reality into their questions because they're basing them often on real world scenarios that they understood have happened and could be of interest to and usefulness to the daily work of a CPA. But we just take that material out in order to make the testing process as smooth as possible.
We want to balance verisimilitude, one of my favorite words, make it look like real life, but take out those things that might be upsetting.
The unnecessary details that don't really help them answer the question.
Right, we don't need to talk about destruction of a building as a result of earthquake or tornado. Imagine your town was just wiped out by a tornado, and here's a question talking about a tornado. That's gonna bring up all kinds of emotions. And we can just say, you know, due to a weather event, or, you know,
a serious weather event,
right? So there, as much as possible, we remove those things. We also take out other distracting things, like Tim has a great example about if you want to add, you know, names into a test question, Jack and Jill. And then Jack and Jill went up the hill is going to go through the head of every single person who reads that question. And that's just not fair. You know, test taking is hard enough. So it's really important. And there's other little things, like we keep dates and years. We need to use dates because, you know, when is the tax filing deadline? Or but imagine someone writes a test question where business activity happens on December 25th. And a majority of the candidate population would say, hey, wait a minute, who's working on Christmas? And so that's something that we just need to keep in mind. Let's just pick a different date.
Easy enough.
And we do not assume that people have any particular cultural orientation. So we take all of those ideas out as well. We do not assume that everyone, December 25th is an important date, because for much of the world, it's not.
But we do know that there are a number, and wherever possible, there are things we will miss, but we do everything in our power to take those little bits out that are not critical to the question, so that they have the least likelihood of affecting a candidate positively or negatively. Another thing we do is there are certain topics that, you know, studies have been done are topics that are easier for women or easier for men or easier for people of different socioeconomic groups. And we try to remove those things as well.
You want everyone on a level playing field, essentially.
Yeah. I remember reading an article that said that a study was done that test questions that refer to football, women don't do as well on them. And ones that mentioned laundry detergent, men don't do well on it. Now, this is a very dated study, but the question had nothing to do with football and had nothing to do with laundry detergent. But it's almost like the women would just shut the question down. Oh, I don't know anything about that. You know what I mean? And of course, I'm making huge generalizations. I know lots of women who love football, and my husband does all the laundry. So, but you know, that sort of thing, we just try to keep an eye on it. You know, if you talk about yachts, people who have no experience with boats may not be able to really visualize what the question is asking.
So I'm wondering if our listeners out there, if this was ever something they even considered of, you know, how behind the scenes we are working to ensure every word and every sentence of each test question is completely clear on the first reading, and that all this behind the scenes thought process has gone into it of consideration for the candidate and how they're going to interpret the question. Now, Tim, you mentioned earlier the need to take logic out of the exam. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes. We do not expect accountants to be experts in informal or formal logic. However, there are certain issues that are brought up by certain logical function words such as or and if those words are not properly used, a person who has knowledge of logic could misinterpret them, and there in these instances there could be more than one correct answer. So even though we do not expect CPAs to have a background in logic, we remove those logical pitfalls from the questions just in case there is someone who understands the logical function of the word or. For example, I tell the writers never to put the word or in their answer choices, because when the word or is included in a sentence, that logically allows the reader to eliminate one the material on either side of that word or. So if I say the person ate beans or rice, this logically means that the person ate beans or that the person ate rice, and you can ignore the one aspect of it or the other.
And actually, if there's another option that says beans or a chicken, and the answer is actually beans, either one of those options could be considered correct.
That's right. So you will rarely see the word or in our answer choices, except if it's at the end of a sentence and you're not distinguishing between the two words that are separated by the word or. These are issues that people normally are not thinking about. However, we take care of them in order to prevent serious misunderstandings.
Is there anything else you guys want to address that you think would be interesting for a candidate to know about when it comes to the language of an exam question?
Well, I would say that when you read the CPA test questions, you can take us at our literal word. Read the words literally as they are presented to you in context. Now, when I say you can take us at our literal word, that means in the context of the entire sentence. So if we say something, you can count on it as being very carefully examined as to that we mean exactly that and nothing else.
Don't try to read too deeply into a question. The information you need is provided. Don't assume anything extreme or outlandish.
We know
well,
what happens when you assume.
Well, this could be the scenario, right? This could be a scenario, you know, this, I know of this one person, you know, out of a million where this weird little thing happened. That's not what we're asking for.
Right. You have no justification to add scenarios to a question. Well, what if, what if, what if? Don't worry about the what if in most cases, because if that information is important to the question, it's already provided. The what if is you could look at what about this rule, what about that regulation? Yes, that's fine, but don't add presuppositions or assumptions to the scenario that has been provided for you.
Another thing that often comes up is I'll run into a CPA candidate and they'll say, oh, you're the ones who try to trick us. And my answer is always, we never want to trick you.
It's quite the opposite.
It's the complete opposite. And there are times when questions are written that end up sounding a little tricky. And that's where the test developers come in and we say, no, you can't ask it that way, because we're not trying to trick them. We're trying to really get at, do they know the subject matter? And by tricking them, we're not going to get at that information about the candidate. Well, one of the things that we do with new item writers is try to level set them so they understand what sort of difficulty level we're going for, and that to make them understand and not have the misconception like a lot of candidates about tricking, and that the question really needs to present everything they need to know, and we really want to know, does the candidate know the right answer? So keeping tricking out of it. And Tim works very closely with the item writers to guide them to the proper way to ask a question. Instead of just taking the questions and fixing them, he gives them feedback so that they learn from it. And some of our item writers really could do our job at this point because they've had so much experience and they retain it and they share it with the other item writers.
And it must be interesting for them, since they were all candidates once and they probably didn't give much thought to the language and all the detail that goes into it. And now they're sort of on the other side of it and they really do know what goes into it. So I think it is that relationship between the item writers and you guys that you're all sort of, you know, in sync together.
Yes. Right?
Now, somebody might think that we use this word distractor for the incorrect answer choices as if we're trying to distract the test taker from the correct answer. And this is not trick the test taker. There is no misleading language involved. It's just a stark presentation of a point of view or a of a an idea, and it should be, according to our standards, definitely incorrect.
Yes, the whole point is the distractors should look attractive to poorly prepared candidates. So if you don't really know the answer, they should all look good. So that will do a good job of pulling away the candidates who just don't know the right answers, who don't know the material. And that's the whole point of the test question. Let's get the candidates who know the answer to answer it correctly and the other ones to guess because they just don't know.
You hear that, listeners? Make sure you're doing your proper preparation before the exam so that you don't fall into that category of, you know, the wrong answers seeming attractive to you.
Yes, and we look at the statistics after the items are pre-tested, and we look at how well they discriminate in a good way. People see the word discrimination as a bad thing, but it really is pulling apart the question and saying, are the high-performing candidates getting this question correct, and are the low-performing candidates getting it incorrect? So it's doing a good job of separating those two groups.
And what makes a candidate high-performing versus low-performing?
Well, how they do on the rest of the exam. Mm-hmm.
So how did you guys get into what you do? I mean, in terms of, you know, analyzing the language of the exam, do you have backgrounds in, you know, Tim, you mentioned in linguistics, you know, English? What? How did you come to be in your positions?
My path was a little more roundabout. I started out working for an investment company, and I was an economics major in college, but I always had a strong English background, and I considered majoring in English. And then I thought, you know, well, economics will look better on my resume. So, but my whole career, I've been sort of balancing between systems and language. Even when I was doing software development, I was also reading through editing people's memos because I always had strength in language skills. So I was hired many, many years ago to do software testing for an exam that was going computer-based that had simulations. And while I was software testing, I noticed that there were some typos in the exam questions. And so I started commenting on, you know, if you reworded it this way, and they needed a test developer, so they offered the position to me. And that started me on the path of test development. So I didn't have any formal background in it, but I had the language skills that helped me. And you also have to be able to communicate with people, you know, disagree with them in a committee meeting and suggest alternate wordings. And, you know, so it's art and it's science at the same time.
It's tricky because you don't want to offend people by saying, you know, the way you wrote this, it's not going to work, but yeah, because, you have to do it in a nice way.
Right. Sometimes you're dealing with the writer. Sometimes you're dealing with a different group of people but you need to be proactive. You need to point things out, but you have to be nice about it. So it's really an enjoyable career to go into. I really love working with the subject matter experts. I've worked with other industries in the past, but the exercise is the same, and you get to learn so much of the subject matter while you're doing the test development work.
So do you feel ready to take the CPA exam today, you think?
I do not.
But you know what goes into the wording of the question, so that's good.
I do.
How about you, Tim?
Well, after I finished my doctoral work in linguistics at the University of Illinois in Urbana, I taught linguistics at a few universities for a while, but I wanted to prove to myself that linguistics is useful in the world, in the real world. And I found my way to Educational Testing Service, where for many years I worked on the reasoning sections of the law school admission test, the LSAT, the graduate record exam, GRE, and the graduate management admission test, GMAT. And I worked on those exams for many years with a team of linguists and logicians who were necessary for those reasoning questions. What we discovered also in the reasoning group where I was working at ETS was that the certification questions in the certification exams at ETS also needed our linguistic and logical expertise. And so it was a natural progression for many of us at ETS to move on eventually to the CPA exam when the exam started to get bigger and go into computer-based testing.
Which was in 2004, right?
We 2004, went and I started working for the exam in 2002. What I've done is bring my knowledge of linguistics and logic and the rigorous treatment of these questions that was necessary for the LSAT, which is the most litigious group of candidates one would ever imagine to be writing for. I'm applying those same techniques to the CPA exam to make it as fair as possible.
Now, Tim, you mentioned before that you worked with linguists, and I must have misheard this. I heard magicians, but I think it's a word that sounds like it, right?
I tried to say linguists and logicians.
Logicians, okay. Yes, it'd be cool to work with magicians, all right?
Yeah, and sometimes logic looks like some kind of strange magic when logicians go on about their about the meaning of or, and actually, what we are trying to do, practically speaking, for the CPA exam is to take any of those questions and those issues out of consideration so you won't, as a candidate for the exam, have to deal with the logical issues. So we need logic in order to take the logic out of the questions. That is, the logical pitfalls that are in ordinary wordings of materials that isn't so highly worked on, because these are really high stakes linguistic materials that we're working on and that we're developing.
Now, one of the things that I learned from Tim when I started AICPA almost 11 years ago is how evil Roman numeral questions are.
And why is that?
Many organizations use them, and they can be written well, but they can also be written poorly. And most people are probably familiar with them, where it presents a question and then it gives you Roman numeral 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then the options are any different, you know, combination of those Roman numerals. And everyone can thank Tim for removing every single one of them from the CPA exam and anything that is faintly reminiscent of a Roman numeral type question.
That we call Roman numeral questions in disguise. This is because while working in the 90s at ETS on the LSAT and GRE, we started to realize that these Roman numeral questions are much too complicated from a logical point of view than is necessary to get at the information that we want to know about the candidates. And so those Roman numeral questions present logical problems for the candidates to solve, rather than just answering factual material that we need to test. So actually, there is no good reason to use that type of question in any certification exam, because they are so logically complex that they fool the writers themselves. The writers themselves fall into the logical pitfalls and don't realize that the question that they just wrote does not have one and only one correct answer, but rather has four plausibly correct answers.
With the evil or in all of the options.
And then they would put the word only or and then only, which can be read as just.
Yeah.
So we take them out.
So I had the pleasure of taking a licensure exam early in my working career, and I knew the subject matter, and I barely passed the exam because the questions were so poorly worded that I walked out of it saying, I don't even know how I did, because most of the questions, I didn't understand what they were asking. And about 15 years later, I got to be test developer for that exam, and I got to rework all of the test questions. It was so satisfying to take these questions and clean them up and know that I was making a better exam for the candidates who came after me. It was really very satisfying.
So when people read news articles about standardized exams and the writer might be criticizing the exam, it really matters which exam, written by whom, written by which experts. Some important exams perhaps do not have the same type of staff that we have for the CPA exam and that they have in the major tests at Educational Testing Service and other major testing organizations.
Well, I think it's coming through today, the critical role each of you play on the exam and how necessary it is to really scrutinize on the language. And I want to thank you personally, Tim, for your contributions to the GMAT. I took that years back, and now I can think back on, you know, your impact on it and the language, because I don't remember being confused by any of the questions, but I didn't even think about it that way.
There aren't a lot of testing programs that have linguists on them. They have people who have very strong English backgrounds. And this is the first exam I've worked on that has had a linguist on staff. And I always say, I know if something's right or it's wrong, but I can't really explain why. And Tim can explain why. So I've learned a lot from Tim since coming here.
Well, thank you.
So I guess, you know, to sum up, you know, there's only one right answer to the multiple choice questions. We are not out to trick you. What you see is what you get. You know, if you're prepared for the exam, you know, you'll be able to more easily narrow in on what the right answer is. So now that you've had a glimpse into the behind the scenes preparation of an exam question and all the scrutiny it goes under regarding the language, hopefully you'll feel a little more comfortable and acquainted with the material you're being tested on. So Tim, Renee, I want to thank you guys for joining us today and explaining the importance of the language and all the work you guys do to help bring an exam question to life without any confusion to our candidates.
Well, thanks for letting us come and talk about one of our favorite subjects.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Next Stop CPA. Got an idea for an upcoming episode topic, or just want to let us know what you think of the podcast? Share your thoughts with us at nextstopcpa@aicpa-cima.com. And don't forget to visit aicpa.org/CPA exam for the latest exam info.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered, and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.